Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So the Media Project is underway, and we have a lot to talk about today. And we start by noting, by the way, and we'll get to the introduction in just a moment, they're now charging tax for newspapers in Maine. It's terrible.
I know.
Anyway.
I don't understand. Maybe you could tell me about it.
I will. Okay. I'll be happy to explain it. Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, is over here. Rosemary Arameo from the University of Albany, investigative reporter and professor now. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, where we operate here in the state of New York, where you don't pay a sales tax when you buy a newspaper.
Just one more barrier to people reading things that they really should be reading. If I were a teacher, I'd assign it. Oh, wait, I am. I do.
And how many of your journalism students would be reading journalism if they weren't assigned it?
Well, that's kind of depressing, Rex. You know, they don't read it. They listen to it from their friends. They text it. But reading it is
They listen
gone.
To The Daily Show.
Listen to The Daily Show, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So that's so interesting. Now, the question is, would your students who are now reading it because you've told them to read it or make them read it, would they be not reading it if they had to pay another penny in sales tax?
Yeah, money's definitely an obstacle to young readers. Even movie prices prevent some students from going to see movies, you know, that they absolutely don't want to. You assign them one and they'll complain about that. So, yeah, this is a barrier to people reading newspapers, as if we needed more barriers.
As if we needed more. Anyway, we got a piece of mail chastising you, Rosemary. Did you see this?
No, I didn't.
It's not so bad. It's
I just heard
so
my
bad.
Mother this morning. Now what?
It's too bad. Carl in Connecticut writes to say, "Dear Rosemary, you need to be ever so slightly corrected." So it's a nice, gentle correction. Evolution, he says, is not a fact. It is a scientific theory. However, genuine scientific theory is a real thing, and the rest of the media has debased the word. I've given up on them getting it right, but not you. And he's making the point that in science, a scientific theory is something which is observed and held to be true until the point where it no longer works.
So Einstein and Darwin and the other greats would just be theoretical, and they would not, although their stuff and global warming has certainly held up. Yeah. So I'm on Rosemary's side.
I stand corrected.
Not really.
I can understand his point.
Scientifically,
however,
you have to be with him.
It is that point, however, that has led the other side to say, well, it's just a theory. Here's our theory of, you know, creative invention. And it makes it easier. It's just a theory that the world is warming up. And so, therefore, here's our theory that it isn't at all. The actual argon of science makes it much easier to attack. I think that's bad. And I think that's your job, Carl, not ours as journalists.
And could you help me with the word argon?
Jargon.
Argon?
Argo, you know, A-R-G-O-T, right? Help me, Rex. I need an editor here.
We all need editors. That's the problem with radio. You don't have any editors.
No editors to help. Yeah. The special language that is immediately clear to other scientists, but not to the rest of us.
Even though it is, in fact, a theory, it is a theory that has withstood the test of time and multiple attacks. So it is. The problem is communicating science to ordinary readers, and that is often a problem for journalism. And so we simplify it, as you did, by saying something is a fact. You know, evolution is fact. It is not actually fact. It's a theory, but it is a theory that we accept to be true if we have any concept of intelligence at all.
Okay, that's interesting. Thank you, Carl.
Yeah, there we go. Other big news of the week is that the Washington Post sale to Jeff Bezos has closed. So, in fact, Jeff Bezos now owns the Washington Post. No real change yet, except that what he has said after visiting the Post is that with his small share of his $25 billion,
Which comes from?
from Amazon.com,
right,
from his wealth. He hopes to give them the runway, he said, at a financial cushion that will allow the Post time to conduct experiments that could lead to a successful business model. You know.
Well, he's a bright guy, and I'm sure he has a theory, get it, on how to do it.
A theory. You know, I went yesterday, as we were speaking, to the new offices, speaking of different ways of operating, yeah, and different approaches, different theories. I was in Syracuse, and I stopped by the new office of the Syracuse Media Group, which is what has replaced what used to be called just the Post Standard, you know, in Syracuse.
Now, let's get this straight. Is there still a Post Standard?
There is, but they only deliver a full newspaper 3 days a week. Tuesdays, uh-huh, Thursdays, and Sundays are the only days that you can really get the full newspaper, the Post Standard. There are on newsstands the other days of the week a little sort of thin version that is sort of a thrown together printed version of the website. But their primary focus 7 days a week is Syracuse.com, the website. And this is very interesting because this is a model that's being pursued in a lot of other cities, especially by this company that owns Syracuse Media Group, which is the Newhouse family, Advance Publications. So this is happening in New Orleans and Cleveland and Newark and a number of different places. And what was interesting to me is that you walk into Syracuse Media Group and you do not feel like you're in a newsroom. It doesn't feel like an office that any of us have really experienced. Nobody has an assigned desk. It looks more like a cafe. Everything is wireless. People plop down where they happen to find a space. A reporter may be sitting next to a circulation salesperson or an ad executive. There are only two offices, the publisher and the emeritus.
Sounds like Bloombergian stuff.
It is very Bloombergian, I think. I think that's exactly the idea.
Who had this, you know, concept of just everybody sits in a big room.
Yeah. And I think they are trying to inspire that kind of creativity or that kind of risk-taking and let's try new things and see how it works. I saw little clusters of people in standing meetings. You don't sit down at meetings either, yeah, because they want to keep them moving. And I saw clusters of people working on little projects and they carry their laptops around. It's all really different for those of us who have had traditional experience in
newsrooms. First of all, I want to congratulate you, Rex. I understand that the Times Union for the second year in a row has been named as the outstanding newspaper in New York State in its class.
That is true.
And it's a fairly big class, and I just think it's terrific. So.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
I'm glad you can stay another year this week. Yeah.
I get to keep my slot on the media project, yeah, then? Mm-hmm. This is great. Thank you.
And any kind of time you want to drop by for a cup of coffee, it's yours.
That's great. One of the things that was also very interesting, and this is really somewhat controversial, I would think, is that there's a large flat screen with a lot of charts on it right next to the president of Syracuse Media Group's office. And on this flat screen are all the metrics of how stories are trending. Here's the story that most people are clicking on right now.
It's great.
Here's yesterday's top story. Here's how many visitors to our site were yesterday, how that compares in overall, you know, every other Wednesday in history and every other Wednesday recently. It is interesting because you can see what people like. And one of the difficulties, of course, in the new world of making journalistic choices in this is that are you influenced too heavily by what people like as opposed to what they really need to know?
We had a lesson in class yesterday in a reporting class about the shutdown of government, and I asked which of my students had read it and what they knew about it. And the idea, of course, was how do you make a story that is inherently not of interest to that group? They don't care about government.
Yeah.
Right, but extremely important. How do you make it interesting to them? And here's what they listened to. They knew about the story of the World War II veterans who had been turned away from the World War II monument and they burst in. They knew that story in detail. They knew about PandaCam being shut down.
Mm.
They knew the Jon Stewart show. Jon Stewart did an amazing, funny, and pungent piece on it and squarely blamed House Republicans in it. That's the way that story is filtering down to this age group that, of course, doesn't read newspapers or watch TV. So it's opinionated, it's humanized, it's soft news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, that's right. And so no matter what Rex says that we have to, and he's right, that we have to be very careful about what we're doing here, you're NBC News and you're looking for ratings, and you can take the panda story, those two little beautiful pandas, and show them, or you can show the guy in the wheelchair at the memorial being turned away, but it doesn't begin to tell the story of what's really going on. You know, Rex, I know you're going to criticize me for doing this.
Oh, boy.
but, you know, I wrote a column on Yo-Yo Ma. And I got a call from my editor at the Berkshire Eagle who said it was because they're all doing it now, as my mom would say, said, look, your column last week was the most read thing in the paper.
Uh-huh.
And then he said, could you write another one? And so I did.
And you wrote about Yo-Yo again?
Yeah. It was a different context. Uh-huh. And it was about Lang Lang and Yo-Yo and, you know, this and that.
Isn't that the name of the pandas and the panda cam?
I thought that's what he was talking about. I forgot to tell us.
Okay, well, that's my self-serving declaration.
Well, no, I think it's fine. It's always been this way. We've always made front page choices based upon what's interesting and what's important. Something either is so interesting that it has to be on the front page, even if it's not important, or it's so important that it has to be on the front page, even if it's not very interesting. But we've relied upon sort of a human judgment to do that. And I just worry that sometimes, especially in the digital world, the judgments are being made entirely by the numbers.
Sure, but aren't we so imperfect as human beings, Rosemary and Rex, that our imperfections are shown in terms of what we like the most? So, you know, we don't know a lot. We're fairly ignorant. So pandas and, you know, I look at the Daily News every morning and the New York Post. And of course, I'm very upset because they show these women in states of undress. And that goes directly to our imperfections also. Personally, I would prefer if those were not in the paper.
Uh-huh. And you slip right over that page, I'll bet, don't you?
Yes. I say, isn't this disgusting?
Uh-huh. Very good. I'm glad that you look at it just so that you can tut, tut. Yes. Oh, my goodness.
I have nothing to add.
There's very little you can say
on top of
that.
There's the word pigs that stand
around. Yes, I'm yelling it in my head.
So it is always catering to a certain audience, I guess. But the difficulty is sort of withstanding that. It depends. If you're only trying to be entertaining, if you're trying to be just fluff, that's one thing. But journalism has always, of course, had a higher calling.
It's not a choice, though, or it didn't used to be. You know, journalism could be everything. It could be a potpourri in the newspaper and the magazine. And, I read everything. I was up all night listening to the broadcasts about the shutdown. But I also can tell you everything about Kim Kardashian, too. You can hold both of them in your head. You know, it's not, and I don't like, you can hold the trivial in your head along with the interesting and important. And I don't like that it's been up to journalists to make that decision.
It always has.
It's supposed to, the new age is supposed to have loosened that. And I'm not sure that I'm actually seeing that.
Yeah.
Where you get everything
up. But I saw this thing the other day. Yesterday, the big news came out that Mia Farrow said that her son might have been the son of Frank Sinatra, as opposed to Woody Allen.
Oh, my.
And this became viral. I mean, viral. And, of course, you know, the press can be manipulated. This guy, who's very bright, Yale Law School, this and that and everything else, and who is...
The son.
The son,
And has great blue eyes.
Yeah, and has blue eyes.
Absolutely.
So this is going to help the son. Mia, of course, who, you know, can be a little wild, gets a lot of publicity out of it.
And it's great for the Sinatra reputation because he would have been 78 at the time of conception. So this is a great thing. Not that there's anything wrong out of it.
Not at all. There were guys like
Casals. We have now discussed Sex Lives of the Stars longer than we have the shutdown of the U.S. This is exactly what's wrong with media.
You are so much better than the rest of us, Rosemary. Thank you for that. I have another?
Yes. This is true. Actually, and you know, we struggle with this all the time. I worry, here's a judgment that I make every day that I have to confess troubles me, but I do it all the time. I'm the editor of a local newspaper. Our focus is local news because that is what differentiates us, we say, from everything else. Nobody else covers the capital region the way this newspaper does, and so that's why that's our front page. But the fact of the matter is, following that as our differentiator also shuts us off from giving people a true view of the full world. When I listen to the BBC News on WAMC, I hear stuff that does not appear in the Times Union, that I'm not putting on the front page of the paper. And I worry, am I therefore shutting out the world? Or should I just say, you know what? People get that news from the BBC and WAMC. And so it would be foolish of me to replicate that.
Well, it's interesting you say that now that we're talking about the BBC for a second, which we do play. And that is that a lot of people, I don't see a lot of this stuff, at least maybe I'm not reading it correctly, but I don't see a lot of the stuff that the Beeb carries in the front page of the New York Times either. So it isn't only that the Albany Times Union doesn't do it. It's also that we hear stuff, and I get up very early in the morning and I listen to the Beeb, so I don't play it. We hear stuff that what's going on in Rwanda, what's going on here, what's going on here, that you would never really see here.
Well, maybe they pay extra attention to Commonwealth countries. That could be that that's just part of their news judgment.
My mother routinely, she did it yesterday, said, how come I'm not seeing anything in the paper? She's a diehard Times Union reader. I don't see anything in the paper about this shutdown you're talking about. And I said, well, that's Washington, Mom. You're not going to read about that extensively here.
But you did, didn't you, Rex? You had.
You know what I'm saying? It's not like on the front page.
She was pointing out exactly what you've said, that you're going to find what's happening.
The Berkshire Eagle did have it, I believe, on the front page.
A wire story?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I would argue that maybe they failed to get the local angle on the story that
which the Times Union did. Mm-hmm. It had the impact of New Yorkers on it. But, you know, The Guardian is now reporting on America. The truth is it is easier to get news from other sources. And it would be backward looking if the Times Union didn't take advantage of that.
Anyway, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok, CEO of an EPR here, I guess we would call it.
Well, I really want to thank you for your wonderful remarks, both of you, about the success of the $1 million fund drive here on WAMC. And I know you went out of your way to compliment us.
I'm grateful for your acknowledgement of the advertising that supports the Times Union, too. That's great. You know, we all have dollars coming to us to support the journalism that was what this program's about.
Hey, Rex, there's no need. There's no reason to take a tone, as my mother would say. After all, I did come in here and graciously say that your newspaper had just been named the number one newspaper, and here
that's very gracious. And you did a great job of fundraising.
I had to yank it out of you.
I've been sending notes to my friends all the time. I can't believe that you all still have voices or want to talk, for that matter, after 10 days of.
Who said you want to?
One of the phenomena that we've seen is the rise of nonprofit journalism sites. You know, we've talked about ProPublica here. One of the interesting things that is happening is these larger nonprofit sites that have matured a bit over the past few years are beginning to draw money from a lot of other sources. And that is really a healthy thing. Everybody wondered, how is this going to possibly work? Because when ProPublica was founded, this couple, Herb and Marion Sandler, provided 90% of the funding. And now, 6 years in, the Sandler contribution is down to 38%. And this is a really good thing. They got some major foundation money and some other things.
You know, Rex, I've never quite understood, considering the success of an enterprise like NPR or WAMC or other major places, that there isn't more of this. It seems to me that the model is set. Most of the people listening to this radio station right now, in your remarks, have no idea what ProPublica is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's important. It's very important. It's a great model. But it's a fee-for-service country. And, you know, we pay the money and we get the newspaper. And this is going to be something a little different. And it also is great because if the money is coming not from advertisers and the Ford guy does something bad in his hometown, you're much more likely to read about it from a not-for-profit than, I believe, a profiteering newspaper.
Hmm. Like in Detroit, for example,
I'm just making that up.
Yeah.
In other words, somebody gets into trouble, a publisher lifts their eyebrow and says, OS, you know, this is going to cost us advertising.
It could be, but just why would the donors of a not-for-profit be any more straightforward stand-up guys than a publisher would?
Well, you're right. I mean, you make a very good point, although I think there are gradations of greed. That's my own feeling about this. And the more removed you are from the operation, it's true. But we just saw the Koch brothers, who were giving big money to PBS, pulling their money because they didn't like, you know, a program that was going to be aired.
Yeah. And there is that hazard. I agree with you. I think that there is a real potential for not-for-profit journalism in local sites around the country. But it is a hard thing, as you demonstrate. You know, you work very hard to get this $3 million a year from your listeners, and you have a loud mouthpiece to make this happen. And if we were to try to do the same thing...
I have a loud mouthpiece.
I mean, you have the station itself. I mean, you reach a lot of people and
you
draw the money out of them.
You have a loud mouthpiece in your newspaper also, I might want to say.
Yeah, but it would also cost us a lot more. The spending to produce the Times Union is a lot bigger than this enterprise.
It's more than $7 million a year.
It is indeed. And it would cost us, I mean, to try to raise that amount of money from donors would be very difficult. And if you replicate that in 1,500 places across the country where there are daily newspapers, I think it would be hard.
I don't mean to get into a altercation with you here, an intellectual altercation with you, Rex. But in your company, there is something called profit. So much to run the newspaper and so much for the bosses. Whereas in this enterprise, in the nonprofit enterprise, I don't think that's true.
Yes, but even in the days when newspapers made a lot of money, like when if you take Warren Buffett, whose Buffalo News used to make a margin of 40%, even if you were, like, say, take away the 40% that the Buffalo News spent on profit, they would still be, it would still, they would still need $150 million, $200 million a year to operate that newspaper. So it would be something. Yeah, it still is a much, by matter of scale, it's really hard to raise the amount of money that it takes to do that.
To me, all of this is that funding for news production is shaky. The model, the old advertising and circulation model, is defunct. And this is a stopgap measure, these nonprofits, and they remain very rickety. You're looking at what the donor will eventually want from you or demand of you. You're going to look at whether they continue interested in newspapers and maybe healthcare tomorrow or fracking or whatever, and their attention can turn. And the one model that still works, and we are so unwilling to consider it here, is government donations from the BBC model.
Yeah.
Steady money. You know, you can keep track of the government, beat them down if they try to influence content, and you get very high quality journalism, although, as you see in England.
Although when Madam Thatcher became the head of the government, we had a deputation here from the BBC who were told to get their behinds over here and learn how to do it so that they didn't depend on the government. So, you know, depending on who the politician is, who's at the head of something like that and what they're... But I wanted to say one thing, Rex, and ask you and Rosemary your advice. We're getting, an occasional piece of mail, or during the fund drive, an occasional comment from people who are very angry that National Public Radio, which, of course, is different than the local stations, have accepted money from pro-fracking forces for underwriting. And they are saying, how dare you, to us? And I keep saying, it's not us, it's them. I wouldn't do it.
Why not?
Well, I just think that there are some things that are controversial that we would probably avoid.
Oh, why?
And as you may remember, there was a Supreme Court case, Rex, in in St. Louis, in which the KKK tried to underwrite on the St. Louis station, and they took it all the way to the Supreme Court, who said, no, you don't have to take what you don't want.
Well, yeah, you don't have to.
Well, NPR wants to take it. And,
that's
and
right.
I'm sitting here thinking, why would that be a problem? Nationally, fracking is not the debate that it is here in
I think more and more it is.
New
York. I think more and more it is. But okay, assuming that's right. But the fact of the matter is there a special responsibility on NPR's part to be sensitive to its member stations and not to create a firestorm? And by the way, we have a listserv for all of the NPR managers, and they ain't happy because they're all hearing it.
They don't like the money coming in.
That's right. In other words, as Woody Allen might have said, take the money and run is not the model that a lot of people are in favor of.
And are your listeners also going to be upset if you have balanced coverage that suggests that maybe fracking is not as awful as they think it is?
Well, of course we do.
Oh, I think that you're wrong. I think that your reporting genuinely supports the anti-fracking point of view. I'm not taking a point of view on this. I'm just saying that I think that if you actually had a point of view reflected in your reporting that was entirely, let's say, balanced on with the population, your listeners would be up in arms.
Are you talking out the clock? Because I want a word on this. I'll tell you right now. First of all, I deny it. Second, I say that we really do have very balanced news coverage on this. And anybody who wants to come on here and talk about it on either side has been allowed to do that. And also, I'm a little afraid that you're receiving pro-fracking, you know, attitude here.
Let's demonize the person who questions you.
Seems to be reflective of the corporatism that is too evident around the country.
Wonderful.
You could knock balance coverage too. Sometimes it shouldn't be balanced.
That's right.
Global warming and evolution and maybe fracking should not be covered in a balanced way.
Well, there we go. That's going to have to be the last word because we've run out of time here. And if you have some points of view of your own, you can send it to media@wamc.org. That's Rosemary Romeo, Alan Chartok. I'm Rex Smith. We will talk to you next week, we hope.
Follow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's uncle. Ting-a-ling-a-ling.